Jackie filed a complaint to get back his money, but it was to no avail. They gave him back only $126,000. Now he had to start from scratch after years of hard work. The story of his life was so bitter that made some people ask a question as old as history. Do parents have the right to use their children for business? From the dawn of civilization, children have been forced to work. But at the turn of the 18th century, things changed. The Industrial Revolution that had started in Britain laid the foundations for establishing more factories. The factories needed cheap, full-time, and fresh labor force. Children had all of these qualities. They were the best choice to push the wheels of the Industrial Revolution. The majority of boys worked in coal mines, and most of the girls in textile factories. In Britain, they wouldn't even exploit four-year-old kids. After a while, the trend moved on to the United States as well. In the early 20th century in the US, 26% of boys between 10 and 15 worked in factories. They usually had to work between 12 and 16 hours a day. Some factories would lock the doors so the laborers wouldn't run away. In some others, there was no room for hygienic or safety protocols. It is estimated that in 1900, about 7.1 million children were exploited in various sectors in the US. But a few years later, changes got underway. With the advent of new businesses like the cinema industry, the situation changed for children as well. That's why no one was surprised that Jackie Coogan had become famous. Jackie was considered the representative of a large population of children who were employed with the new tactic that has continued to exist until today.
Jules Lund used to work in television as a presenter. Now he connects influencers to the marketplace and feels we ain't seen nothing yet. It is, though, a pretty crowded market already. How do you cut through?
You think it's a crowded market, but it's not even close.
Really?
Yeah. What you've got to imagine is years ago, the attention of the masses was held by a few TV networks or a few radio networks or print, whereas now the attention of the masses is held by everyday people.
Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to Ryan's World.
Ryan Kaji is born in 2011 in Texas, the U.S. He's a 10-year-old kid who's known as one of the highest-earning YouTubers. In 2020, Ryan managed to earn $30 million from YouTube. Now he's turned into an outstanding figure. He creates visual content about toys. As Ryan unboxes the toys and sometimes talks about them, his subscribers increase by the day. He's been creating the videos along with his family since he was four. He owns the most famous channel that introduces toys. Over 30 million subscribers and 48 billion visitors of Ryan's YouTube channel led to the creation of toy and clothes production lines. Furthermore, Ryan and his family have direct and indirect advertisement as well. The Federal Trade Commission has recently started an investigation on Ryan. Some of the sponsors had not been disclosed, and some of the advertised products were not healthy. These are the latest controversial issues about him. Despite all this, Ryan is known as an influencer who will pile up his wealth day by day.
They are basically adopting a don't ask, don't tell stance about all the children that are on their site. But at the same time, they're profiting enormously by hosting content that is deliberately designed to attract kids.
YouTube, based on whatever percentage they're getting of that, is probably making $10 to $15 million just off of Ryan's videos. Particularly on YouTube, we have been concerned about the rise of unboxing culture and, you know, how people like Ryan and EvanTube have become such powerful forces in children's lives. If you are a child and you are unboxing a toy because you've been paid to promote it, then your whole 12-minute unboxing video is an ad. Children don't have that understanding, and they have it even less when the person telling them this is masquerading as their friend on YouTube who's just really excited about opening a toy.
Ryan isn't the only famous child on YouTube. Anastasia, who's 7 years old, also has a YouTube channel with 107 million subscribers and 61 billion visitors. She's also been one of the strange phenomena in recent years.
You have 75 million subscribers on YouTube.
Wow!
Have you met all of them?
No, but I'm gonna look for
them. In 2020, she earned $18 million. According to statistics, in 2019, influencers pocketed nearly $8 billion. The figure reached $15 billion the following year. As it looks, children like Ryan and Anastasia form a significant part of the industry.
YouTubers might be getting paid $15,000 to $50,000 per sponsored video. Influencer marketing is one of the fastest growing segments, so I think they're estimating over the next couple of years it'll grow to $24 billion.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. And our company only plays a small role in that, but we've already paid out $20 million just to everyday micro-influencers simply for taking photos on their phone celebrating brands they already use and love. So you can start to see the absolute opportunity.
YouTube isn't the only place you can find children influencers. Instagram has also been an active platform for these children. These children's activities are totally different from Anastasia and Ryan. For example, the Wixens boys have their own stories. For years, the three brothers' mother has been posting their pictures on her Instagram page. A few years ago, Ms. Wixon decided to share her children's daily pictures. At first, she used to post ordinary pictures of their trips and happy moments within family. But gradually, things changed. More and more people followed the page because of the boys' attractive pictures. Ms. Wixon received advertisement offers. Now her page with several hundred followers looked like any other family account. The boys can be seen in different situations, but this is just what you see on the surface. Behind the scenes, a professional photographer, a sponsor, and many goods are hidden to be advertised. From foodstuffs and hygienic products to clothing and toys. It isn't clear how much the Wixons earn from this page, but what is certain is the boys are always there. If it wasn't for Ms. Wixon's sons, the page wouldn't be able to earn thousands of dollars every month. But earning money through children is just one side of the story. The other side of the coin is an important development that will reveal itself in the future.
Dad, I feel a little drop.
It's all right. It's a little rain, baby. It's all right. You got a jacket on. It'll protect you. You warm?
Yeah.
Good.
Josh Biggs is Taylan's manager, her bodyguard, and her dad.
When this photo was posted on Instagram when Taylan was around 10 months old, their lives were about to change.
Fashion Kids, which was a big platform on Instagram, saw the photo, liked the photo. Next thing you know, the Kardashians came along somehow at 18 months old. They picked her up to get involved with their kids' clothing line. And then, you know, she grew into what she's doing now. 3 years old, walked the runway, youngest runway model in the world at Gotham Hall, New York Fashion Week. And she's kind of just taking New York Fashion Week by storm.
Sharing children's pictures on the internet is an important issue that starts even before they're born. Some parents start their job with ultrasound pictures, and then it comes to shopping for the baby, and then the pictures of the mother who's waiting in the doctor's office. But that's not all. Even if a couple doesn't want to spread the news that they're going to have a baby on the internet, they won't succeed. The search algorithms on the internet find out about the pregnancy of a mother even before gynecologists. As soon as you type the first few words, the algorithms start their mission. From searching for a gynecologist's office to finding the symptoms of a disease, their job is to expose you to advertisements related to giving birth. This is what they do business with. When the search algorithms realize that you're about to give birth to a baby, something else happens as well. It will record your baby's first presence on the internet, the first footprint that will have a strange effect on the baby's future. Concealing pregnancy from the internet is as hard as raising children away from it.
Ava Ryan was 2 years old when her mum Katie posted this video on Facebook for the rest of her family to watch.
Never in a million years would have thought that that would translate to anyone. To me, it was just like super nonsensical toddler talk that I thought was funny. And I posted it on Facebook and my aunt was like, oh, you need to, that would go viral. And I'm like, you're crazy. Like, there is no way in the world that would go viral. And it did.
To date, the video has had more than 600,000 views on Facebook and another 8 million views on YouTube.
I smell like beef.
And all for you saying one line.
Yeah, I smell like beef.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. I just said I smelled like beef because I actually did. I smelled like the grill. So I just said I smell like beef. I don't know why I said that, but, you know.
You just said it over and over and people loved it.
I just said it over and over and people loved it, so... Yeah, that's cool.
So that's what we call viral. That's when a video goes viral, right?
Viral.
Posting the pictures of children posted by their parents has turned into a challenging issue during the past 10 years. Some people say parents are free to share their children's pictures, but some others believe that the children's privacy is violated by doing so. What will happen if children are not happy that their parents have published their private pictures after they grew up? The internet is brimming with pictures and videos of children. The pictures of eating food, smiling, crying, sleeping, or their illness. Parents gradually shape their children's identity by sharing their pictures. A two-year-old kid cannot even pronounce the word the internet, but tens of thousands of strangers might know everything about their behavioral habits. Some old statistics show that over 80% of children under 2 years old in the U.S. are in the digital world in this way. Parents don't post their children's pictures with ill intentions. But good intentions don't count in this matter that much. By doing so, the children's digital footprints will be complete. Today's babies and children will be tomorrow's teenagers. Sooner or later, they themselves will become internet users. So their first encounter with the internet can be scary. They'll see hundreds of pictures of themselves only in a few seconds, hundreds of pictures of their birthday parties, crawling and playing. The pictures of their illness, getting wounded, crying, and thousands of other circumstances and events in the past. Their digital footprints related to the past years will quickly surface thanks to search engines. People have seen those pictures thousands of times and have left comments. Under those circumstances, children are faced with a past they didn't have any role to create. But the bitter reality is, most of the pictures are published by those who are close to the children. Parents shape their children's lifestyle and their digital identity as they wish. But posting the pictures form the identity of not only the children, but also their parents. By showing their children, they try to complete the missing pieces of their own identity for others. In this identity, children are a tool and not a new family member, so the parents can show off.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In the United States, Tennessee state legislators have passed a bill that will allow more guns on school campuses. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. The grieving parents of children who were massacred at the Covenant School in Tennessee in March, or whose children were forced to hide as the shooter smashed their way through, were among dozens of spectators that were booted out of a Tennessee subcommittee meeting about a new law that would allow for more guns on school campuses. The chaotic scene was compounded by parents bursting into tears as troopers from the Tennessee Highway Patrol forced them out of the same meeting that they'd been called to testify in, according to reports from the Tennessee state capital, Nashville. Lowell Russell, a Republican state representative that oversaw the meeting, justified the mass ejection by claiming that spectators had continued clapping, yelling, and holding signs after being ordered to stop. Legislators adopted new rules for attending subcommittee meetings on Monday, banning the public from holding signs in galleries and committees. Come Tuesday, some members of the public skirted the rules by holding up a book titled Joaquin's First School Shooting and a Covenant Strong scarf. Others still held up signs in favor of gun restrictions, clearly to Russell, Lower Russell's ire. Three women who held up signs were the first to be booted from the meeting. One woman yelled, "This is not what democracy looks like," as a trooper walked her out of the meeting with his hands on her back. She was holding a small sign that reads, "One kid is more than all the guns in the world." The first to be thrown out, Allison Polidor of Nashville, Tennessee, called her removal an infringement of her First Amendment rights, telling the Tennessean through tears that we've come to a point where you can't hold up a sign. That's not okay, and that's not democracy. As the room was cleared, the Tennessean reported that the crying of multiple Covenant School parents could be heard, along with the shouts from angry protesters. After the public was expelled, including those who'd sat quietly, state legislators went on to pass House Bill 7064. The bill allows enhanced gun permit holders, cops and military members, both active duty and retired, on duty and off duty, to be able to possess and carry a handgun at any public school building, bus, school campus or school grounds. The legislation was passed in response to the shooting at the Covenant School, which left 3 staff members and 3 young students dead after Audrey Hale, a former student, went on a shooting rampage armed with an AR-style rifle, an AR-style pistol and a handgun before being shot dead by police officers. Tuesday was the second day of a special legislative session called by Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, a Republican, to pass gun reform laws that will make it harder for mentally ill people to buy a gun in Tennessee. Bill Lee's efforts to restrict access to guns were quickly thwarted by Tennessee's deep red state legislature, however, who instead passed HB House Bill 7064 against the pleas of Sarah Shoup Noman, the mother of a survivor of the school shooting incident, and others who testified through tears. The presence of firearms in schools is something I cannot speak against more strongly, Sarah Shoup Noman said, according to the Tennessean. Teachers in this state already lack support in the state in terms of funding, staffing, and being overwhelmed, and you want to arm them? Noman said she spoke on behalf of herself, the Covenant Families Action Fund, and a number of teachers at the Covenant School in Tennessee. The Associated Press has also covered the same story. Families close to a Nashville fatal school shooting broke down in tears on Tuesday after a Tennessee Republican leader ordered state troopers to remove them and others from a legislative hearing room while they waited to testify in favor of gun control measures. The emotional scene was just one of several chaotic moments that erupted during the second day of Tennessee's special legislative session. Republican Governor of Tennessee Bill Lee initially called lawmakers back to the Capitol to consider his proposal to keep firearms away from dangerous people. I was supposed to speak, I was supposed to testify, said Sarah Shoup Noman, sobbing and shaking in front of the silent GOP-controlled House subcommittee room, which was cleared out after some clapping from the public gallery, even though she sat quietly and wasn't holding any signs. As a parent whose child attends the Covenant School, Sarah Shoup Noman is among the family members desperately attempting to address the state's relaxed gun laws after a shooter opened fire inside the school premises and killed 3 children and 3 adults. She was later allowed back to testify against the bill that allows for more teachers to carry guns in school premises. The House subcommittee advanced the bill, though its odds appear longer in the Senate. We're just trying to do something, Sarah Shoup Noman later told reporters as other Covenant parents huddled around her. However, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee's bill has been all but defeated by the Republican supermajority, where legislative leaders have largely refused to consider the issue. Without any debate, 3 variations of similar proposals for so-called extreme risk protection orders carried by Democratic Representative Bob Freeman of Nashville, immediately failed on Tuesday in the same House subcommittee where the public was kicked out. On the first day of the special session on Monday, House Republicans advanced a new set of procedural rules that carried harsh penalties for lawmakers deemed too disruptive or distracting and banned visitors from carrying signs inside the Capitol and in legislative hearing rooms. The Senate and House also signed off on severely limiting the public from accessing the galleries where people have traditionally been allowed to watch their government in action.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah ya Allah subhana
Explaining the services performed for the people. In this start of the new year, I would like to extend my congratulations to all the sirs that are present at this gathering, to the entire nation and especially the troops that are engaged in self-sacrifice on the front lines, the families of the beloved martyrs and to the war disabled and their relatives. I hope that in the same manner that the blessed and almighty Allah right from the start of this movement guided us step by step on the path of victory, I continues with his favors for the victory of Islam and the Muslims. The sirs mentioned a gist of what has been performed in these past few years, but of course not all that has happened, for one cannot explain all of them in these speeches and gatherings, and nor do we have the power to explain them. I have repeatedly asked the relevant authorities to explain the tasks of that magnitude that have been undertaken to the nation. This is especially when you are seeing that all the mass media and all the deviant individuals of the world are constantly telling the people of the world that this victory has not been achieved for Islam until now, rather that this republic is on the decline.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, about the subject of the month of Muharram, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "It is a month which has taught the generations throughout history the path of victory over the lances, a month that witnessed the downfall of big powers against the word of truth." You know, in this sentence, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is talking about the power of truth and righteousness, right until the end. Imam Hussein alayhi salam had the choice to walk away from his impending death. You know that Yazid's preference from the beginning was for him to sign a pledge of allegiance and submit peacefully. Had he done this, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam would have been handsomely rewarded and have retired a life of comfort and luxury in his hometown of Medina. Yet Imam alayhi salam refused to do so. When Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam said, "A man like me could never give allegiance to a man like him," that is Yazid, this was not a statement of arrogance or pride, but rather one of fact. A man who was known for his justice, integrity, a man of honor, someone who people looked up to because of these traits, could not simply fold and give allegiance to a tyrannical ruler. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam stood for what was right till the end and rejected any settlement that involved compromising his high moral standards. This was the easy way and the right way, and Imam alayhi salam chose the latter, knowing full well that it would result in his death.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The countdown until the student loan payment pause is lifted in October is ticking, and some experts worry that once payments resume, many younger Americans will find it hard to get out of credit card debt. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of Yahoo Finance has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new survey, the share of Americans rolling their credit card debt from month to month is for the first time higher than the portion who pay their bill in full. According to its annual credit card satisfaction survey, J.D. Power found that 51% of the American public can't pay off their entire balance each month and instead let it revolve to the next month, accruing interest. The remaining 49%, called transactors, can pay their bills in full each month. According to J.D. Power, that's troubling because from 2018 to 2022, the percentage of those rolling over balances ranged from 40% to 50%. John Cabell, Managing Director of Payments Intelligence at J.D. Power, told Yahoo Finance, "What we have not seen in the past is there are more revolvers than transactors." He added, "It's inflation, it's savings dwindling. We're also seeing rising interest rates, which makes it harder to pay off the balance because it's getting bigger." J.D. Power surveyed 31,418 credit card customers from August of 2022 through to June of 2023. The role reversal also comes as credit card interest rates remain near 40-year highs. Americans have also racked up a record high amount of credit card debt, and delinquencies are inching up as well. Two separate indicators recently showed that Americans have piled on $1 trillion in credit card debt, a first. The Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Missouri, reported total credit card balances and other revolving accounts hit $1 trillion the week of 26th of July, while according to the data from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, outstanding credit balances hit $1.03 trillion in the second quarter. Both were highs for each. The website debt.org has also covered the same story. According to credit scoring company FICO, the average balance on a US credit card was $2,573 in June, up 6.5% from a year ago. Even more concerning, the percentage of accounts past due by one cycle increased 42.6% in the past 2 years and is at the highest level since September of 2017. At the same time, according to Bankrate, the average annual percentage rate on credit cards is 20.6%, the highest since 1985, when the company first started tracking the data. John Cabell, Managing Director of Payments Intelligence at JD Power, said the choice to revolve balances may not be a choice at all for many folks as inflation over the past year or so ate into their budgets. The survey found that of those who were classified as financially unhealthy, 69% rolled their balances over from 1 month to the next. Financial health was measured by a consumer spending savings ratio, credit worthiness, and safety net items like insurance coverage. Many other experts have also worried that the end of the student loan payment pause may mean younger adults will rely even more on credit card debt. He said, pandemic savings are dwindling. Consumers are using their credit card for a lot of everyday purchases. Grocery shopping is the lead purchase type that consumers say they are making. One way consumers could mitigate ballooning credit card balances is to consider installment payment plans offered by certain credit card companies. John Cabell said Chase, American Express, and Citigroup, for instance, provide the option to convert credit card transactions to a lower interest rate and payment plan after the fact. But few consumers use them or even know about them. The survey found usage varying from 9% to 23%, with financially healthy but overextended cardholders among those using these plans the most. John Cabell said, as you see inflation, as you see savings dwindle, as you see interest rates go up, these payment plans should become more of a focus for people looking for a way to not pay double-digit interest rates on what they owe. Fox Business Report has also covered the same story. The countdown until the student loan payment pause is lifted in October is ticking, and some experts worry that once payments resume, many younger Americans will find it very hard to get out of credit card debt. According to a recent study by Quicken Inc., about 53% of millennials and 41% of Generation Z respondents said they were more reliant on credit cards than even before the summer. The survey, which considered 1,002 credit card holders in June, found that 38% were using credit cards to make ends meet. The study found another 35% of the Americans say they believe they would max out at least one of their credit cards by the end of the year, regardless of their income level. One expert says the results are concerning, especially with credit card interest rates hovering over 20%. The end of the pandemic-era student loan forbearance this fall could worsen the financial stability of young adults. Eric Dunn, the chief executive officer of Quicken Inc., says, I'm troubled by the compounding problems facing this group. Many of them are living paycheck to paycheck and relying on credit cards that they may not be able to afford. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York revealed recently the number of credit card accounts grew by 5.48 million to 578.35 million in the second quarter. Outstanding credit balances hit $1.03 trillion, up 4.6% from the previous quarter, the highest level recorded in the series. Just over a week ago, data from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Missouri, also showed credit debt had topped $1 trillion. LendingTree chief credit analyst Matt Schultz says in a statement, $1 trillion in credit card debt is staggering. Unfortunately, it is likely only going to keep growing from here on. What's troubling is how, compared with other age groups, the youngest Americans are already having a harder time making payments on time. For instance, according to the New York Federal Reserve, 18 to 29-year-olds had the highest credit card delinquency rate in the second quarter of this year. At least 8.8% were 90-plus days behind on their payments, up from 8.5% the previous quarter. This was followed by the age group 30 to 39-year-olds, who had a delinquency rate of 7%. The past due rate for those 40 and over was below 5%. The results mirrored what Quicken Inc. researchers found in June. Quicken found almost half, or 49% of millennials and 55% of those earning under $50,000 a year, said they didn't see an end in sight as they lived paycheck to paycheck. Another 25% of those surveyed said they would need to cut back on spending because they were currently buried in a credit card debt.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Africa Today, a show that keeps you updated on events taking place across Africa. From the ever-changing political landscape, culture, innovation, and technology to massive natural resources, we bring the continent closer to you. My name is Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are keeping our eyes on the events in Niger after the July 26 coup that apparently has the support of the masses in the country. Western powers led by France seemingly favor a military option to restore the ousted president. In the second segment of our show today, we are focusing on the intensifying conflict in Sudan that has left thousands dead and millions displaced, amid reports that warring sides in the conflict are committing war crimes.
Niger resisting foreign intervention. Last month's military coup in Niger continues to dominate international news headlines. The Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has expressed support to the path of dialogue to resolve the Niger crisis, but has at the same time given the green light to an armed intervention against the soldiers who took power on July 26 in Niger by activating its standby force. The military leader of Niger, General Abdurrahmane Tchiani, led the coup that ousted President Mohamed Bazoum.
The people of Niger have come out to massively support the coup, which they see as a step towards ending French imperialism and looting of the country's minerals, especially uranium, by this former colonial power. Thousands of coup supporters recently demonstrated in front of a French army base in Niger's capital, Niamey, rejecting any foreign military intervention.
Because of this situation that France wants to impose on us, we don't agree with France. We want French soldiers to leave our country and go to their country. This is Niger, not France. This is Niger, not France.
Yes, we are here for an equal partnership. We are here for a fixed partnership. We are here for 50-50 partnership. We are not here for a dark partnership in the shadows, which is what France has done for years, decades, centuries, controlling us. In Africa, we've studied. We know everything. We are now intellectuals, and we are here to get France out of the way.
Well, for more on the unfolding events in Niger after the coup, we have contacted Collins Nweke. He's a global affairs analyst and ex-chief executive and chairman of Nigerians in Diaspora in Europe. He's also a member of the Green Party in Belgium. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you, Mubarak, for inviting me to your studio to have this conversation.
Now, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, ordered the activation of a standby force after generals ousted President Mohamed Bazoum in Niger. Now, what's your take on this?
The military juntas in Niger seized power by the barrels of the gun from, an elected government and have since then, continue to insert and assert authorities more and more to the point that at this moment they have named a 2021 man cabinet to take care of business. So you see, we have actually transited from the situation of, coup plotters to actually a government. And so the dynamics have changed.
The Sahel, a strategically important region of Africa, has experienced several coups since August 2020. In a bid to prevent more coups, the regional economic bloc, ECOWAS, is exploring a military option to restore the ousted president of Niger.
All the elements that would go into any eventual intervention have been worked out here and being refined, including the timing, including the resources needed, and including how and where and when we are going to deploy such a force. We are determined to stop it. But ECOWAS is not going to tell the coup plotters when and when, where we are going to strike. That is an operational decision that will be taken by the heads of state who are going to be like the commanders-in-chief of this operation.
There have been several coups in West Africa over the past few years, but ECOWAS did not intervene militarily. However, in the case of Niger, this regional bloc is not just content on imposing sanctions on the military government.
Under the chairmanship of, President Bola Tinubu of Nigeria, I think there is a strong desire for ECOWAS to actually shed off that, epitaph of being a toothless bulldog. So I believe that to a large extent, that has informed the decision to actually, go strong, talk tough, in the expectation that, they will send the military juntas running. Well, nothing could be, more incorrect because, more than a week after, almost a week after the deadline expired, they are still there and actually asserting more authority.
Niger is a uranium-rich country, and so it was second-largest supplier of natural uranium to the European Union last year. Niger also supplies at least 20% of France's uranium needs.
While uranium from Niger lights up Europe, this West African country has one of the lowest electrification rates in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, after the coup, the authorities in Niger announced that they will freeze uranium exports to France. This was in response to popular demands by the masses.
We have uranium, we have diamonds, we have gold, we have oil, and we live like slaves. Why should we? Until when? We can't accept it. The French base in Niger must leave. We don't need the French to keep us safe.
Now, how important is the uranium factor in the current developments in Niger?
The European powers, the United States of America, that have a presence in Niger and other parts of Africa, as a matter of fact, are not there because they want to help Africa, playing the Father Christmas and all of that. Certainly not. They are there for their own interests. And those interests are economic interests. Like I've mentioned, 20% of uranium supply goes from Niger to France. And as a matter of fact, it may interest you to know that nearly a quarter of all the uranium received in the European Union as a block in 2022 actually came from Niger. When you hear the ECOWAS talking about military interventions and all of that, it may very well be that they are deriving their strength, their power from external forces that actually have not very much to lose because they are already on a tight corner, so they don't have very much to lose if there is a military intervention.
Now, the United States of America constructed the largest drone base in the world in Niger's Agadez region. France also uses Niamey Air Base 101 as a hub for its operations. Many people in Niger believe that these Western forces in the country are in fact the source of insecurity and terrorist attacks.
Despite the presence of these Western military bases, Niger continued to experience insecurity and terrorist attacks. Questions have been raised on what these Western forces were really doing in Niger.
Could it be that their only interest is the economic? Could it be that it is not in the interest of the United States of America and other powers to see peace return and return permanently in Africa? And so they simply look the other way when they have all that it takes to curb some of these terrorist activities and so on and so forth.
In an interesting turn of events, Burkina Faso and Mali have declared their support for the coup in Niger. They have also warned that any military intervention against Niamey would be considered a declaration of war against their nations.
Now, considering this statement by the Malian official, can we say that a new anti-imperialism alliance is taking shape in the West Africa region?
It does look like with the Niger coup, the process of getting rid of imperialism in Africa has been accelerated. And so there are signs that the time that Macron needed to be able to redraw the map in terms of the Africa policy of France, that he doesn't have that time anymore, because some of these dynamics are playing out in a manner that they didn't envisage. But I believe that it is still early in the day. There are signs that if they choose the diplomatic political solution in this crisis rather than military intervention, that there will be light at the end of the tunnel, some ray of hope awaiting them.
Well, unfortunately, our time is over for today. I would like to thank our guest there, Collins Nweke, a global affairs analyst, for his incisive analysis. We take a short break before our next topic on the ongoing conflict in Sudan. Stay with us.
Sudan war getting intense.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The current conflict in Sudan has been going on over the last 4 months, and there appears to be no end in sight. Now, the capital, Khartoum, is now an urban battlefield between the Sudanese army led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and their rapid support forces commanded by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
So far, thousands have died and more than 4 million people have been displaced inside and outside the country. The United Nations says fighting also created a humanitarian crisis, with more than 20 million people now facing a high level of food insecurity. A Sudanese man from Darfur, one of the regions badly affected by the current conflict, speaks here on why he decided to flee.
We've lost everything. They left us with nothing. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, they just kill everyone.
To discuss the current situation in Sudan, we have contacted David Hunden. He's the founder of the West African Weekly. He's also a journalist and an author. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, there have been unconfirmed reports that some foreign powers are taking sides in the current conflict in Sudan by supplying weapons. Now, is the current conflict in Sudan turning into a proxy war?
Yes, it would seem as if the conflict in Sudan is being positioned as a proxy war, as usual, between East and West. For decades, what used to happen during the Cold War era was, even though the U.S. and Russia would never directly confront each other, they had all these sort of military skirmishes in different outposts across the world. It happened in Korea, it happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Cuba, you know, Vietnam. So it would seem as if in this era, which some people are already starting to refer to as the Second Cold War era, such a thing is also starting to happen. And Sudan, unfortunately, is becoming one of those outposts. Now, regarding the claims that certain powers are supplying weapons to different factions on the ground, obviously, because there is so little verifiable information coming out of the active war zone that is Sudan, it's almost impossible to verify this. However, it would seem consistent with the pattern of such conflicts. It's important to remember that this conflict has dragged on for, you know, several months now, and it's seeming as if, well, where exactly are the weapons coming from?
A catastrophe is unfolding in Sudan, a country that was once touted as the next global food basket. Lives of many young people in Sudan have been shattered, and instead of contributing to the development of their country, many have been forced to flee and are living in chaotic conditions.
The suffering here is beyond anyone's imagination. No food, no water, no place to sleep. We sleep on the streets. You can be beaten by gangs. No respect for women or pregnant mother.
The chaotic situation in Sudan can only benefit the imperialist states which have sought to dominate Sudan and the African continent for centuries.
You know, certainly from the history of East and Central Africa, we've seen several examples of this where you just have these civil conflicts which don't really make that much sense. There isn't really any strategic benefit to anyone from taking part in these unending forever wars between two equally poor people. But somehow they just keep on fighting for years, sometimes for decades. And what tends to happen is you find out in the background there's someone who is benefiting from extremely low prices or underpriced exports of primary resources, of minerals. That generally tends to be the case. We saw that happen in Sierra Leone and Liberia. We've seen that happen in Central African Republic. We've seen that happen in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So many places across Africa. So, and as I'm sure you know, Sudan is also, you know, like much of Africa, is a major hub for minerals.
Western powers and the Israeli regime encouraged the rebellion in the south of the country, which resulted in the partitioning and subsequent weakening economically and politically of the newly formed Republic of South Sudan, as well as the North. A South Sudanese citizen, speaking a decade after secession, says the dreams of the people are yet to be fulfilled.
And the reason is because over the last 9 years,
we have not had any peace. And you know, I am a mother. And, you know,